This is MSCI Perspectives, bringing to light insights and analysis that help global investors tackle today's challenges. I'm your host, Adam Bass, and today is March 14th, 2024. Okay, artificial intelligence, AI. Ever since ChatGPT was released in November 2022, large language models, or LLMs, and generative AI have been all over the news, all over earnings reports, academia, basically everywhere. Frankly, at this point, I think even my dog Seamus is familiar with the term Gen AI. So you had to know an episode about this was coming. And we also all know the hopes and fears that surround AI. It's going to usher in a utopia of limitless efficiency at scale. Or it could put everyone out of work. It's going to solve the climate crisis right before it wipes out all of humanity. But love it, hate it, maybe fear it, AI is poised to enter the financial services industry in a very big way. But as our guests point out, maybe not in the way you expect. And all those hopes and fears about AI, they might just be the teensiest off base.
AI is going to play a huge role in investing, but I think of it as sort of, it's an army of interns who don't necessarily know anything about finance, but work really cheap and don't mind being micromanaged. So do you want those interns to manage your portfolio for you directly? Probably not. Is there a lot of value you could get out of that army of interns? Indeed.
That's our first guest for today.
I'm Peter Shepard. I'm head of analytics research for MSCI, leading a big team of mostly quantitative researchers doing lots of different things, including lots of AI. This is potentially, you know, really a facilitator. If you are stuck in drudgery in a really boring, tedious job, AI is evolving. Now it's able to do things that are a little hard for us. They're hard for us mostly because they're maybe kind of boring. The challenge is maybe more tedium, but it's not solving problems that smart people think are hard. The problems that smart people find tedious, yes, smart people find hard. It's not there yet. So it's read every news article that came out today and surface the ones that are relevant to the stocks in my portfolio. That's pretty useful, but it's not read all the news articles and tell me exactly what the market will do tomorrow. It's not there yet. And it's a long way off from that.
Okay, so AI is not coming for my job. And it's not going to just automatically solve all my investment challenges either. Am I hearing that right?
You know, I would say in the short term, no. In the very long term, you know, it's a little bit harder to say one way or the other, right? But for right now, I will say that I believe that, you know, it's not going to automate everybody's job away. It's not going to solve all of our problems.
That would be our second guest for the day.
My name is Andy DeMond. I head up the factor modeling team here at MSCI. We cover all sorts of models, covering equity, fixed income, private assets. And we've been, you know, incorporating AI into our models for a long time, and we're continuing to double down on that effort.
You may have heard Andy say that MSCI has been incorporating AI into our models for a long time. That's true, and we'll get there. But first, let's get back to the part about AI not taking everyone's jobs.
I don't think it's going to be the end of quants. You know, it says they're right on the label, large language models. They're good at language, but they have a ways to go at math, right? I think that's probably going to be coming, but it's not here yet. There's a lot of work to do. I do believe we're at the beginning of, you know, a real transformation in the way that a lot of jobs work. I think it's going to impact a lot of industries, but it's still early days. But they're still really useful in a lot of tasks, right? And we can talk more about exactly how we're thinking about that in terms of risk and portfolio management tasks in a little bit. I do think that, you know, improvements in efficiency and, you know, kind of the changing nature of work will be really, really impactful to a lot of companies. It's going to be material to their bottom lines, right? But ultimately, the questions we're asking now, it's a little bit like saying, you know, do you think that the telephone will lead to huge efficiency gains? I mean, yeah, but it's also going to change the way that the world works and the nature of our jobs.
Definitely, you have a lot of conversations of, let's ask AI to do this thing that I don't know how to do myself. So that's a really common thing. Something that is difficult, let's see if AI can solve it. And that I think is a big misconception today. The areas that we see AI having the biggest impact are sort of three pillars. One is around gathering data. The next is around a new way of thinking about modeling in general, models that combine both numbers and words and other kinds of signals. And then the third pillar is around changing the way we interact with information. Crystal ball predicting the future, not yet.
Before we get to Peter's pillars, let's go back to the idea that AI isn't exactly new. It's been around for a while, and it's been part of investors' toolkits for longer than you might imagine.
MSCI started doing natural language processing way back in 2018.
That's Jay Dermody, MSCI's head of AI product management. We asked Jay to explain just how AI has been used to provide solutions to investors and some of the concerns that clients have expressed as those solutions have evolved.
Way back in 2018, we actually started using natural language processing to look at company filings, news events, and identify collections of companies, you know, for clustering purposes and for understanding co-movement, as well as processing their filings to look for ESG controversies. And so we've had a lot of experience working in natural language processing across a wide variety of disciplines. We came out with a machine learning factor that uses a neural network trained on our traditional factor structure. And I'm very excited. This came out 2 years ago. But since then, it's continued to show positive returns, significantly positive returns since that period.
AI and machine learning have made a lot of leaps since 2018, but somehow most of those leaps remained under the radar. It wasn't until ChatGPT's release that the public at large understood, or started to understand anyway, just how far this technology has come. Since then, society, investors, and even governments have taken notice. And not everyone seems to like everything they've seen.
I mean, clients definitely have a concern around the models themselves. They want to know that the model isn't being used to train on their particular holdings, right, where their holdings might leak out to another investor. Their particular alpha signals might become visible to the broader industry because they're being processed through this large language model. How can they be sure that their questions and answers, their particular content, stays local to them when using these new technologies? And so it's something that MSCI, we take very seriously, as well as the other kind of large providers in this space. Here, we process over 7 million portfolios every day for our clients across all of our different systems. And so we take the sanctity and security of our client portfolios and of our client user data very, very seriously. I think that's true across the industry.
There's certain data that are private to a particular client, like the portfolio holdings or their concern.
That's our last guest for today. It's four, I know. It's a lot. Stick with me.
My name is Dipesh Madani. I lead our AI data and cloud strategy in MSCI. There's certain data that are private to a particular client, like the portfolio holdings or their concern. You know, we want to make sure that we don't train the models with that data. And therefore, we have actually put those guardrails in our systems and through a governance process where we are strictly training with the model publicly available information. And if we are doing a little more proactive, we are actually putting that in a sandbox. It's no different than us hosting our applications on Azure or Google Cloud. It is sitting in isolation. So, similarly, Microsoft, Google, and all the LLMs that we're using
have assured us, and in fact have put public documentation out there, how they're not using our data to train their model, which will then prevent data leakage in the case that our model not training a competitor's model, or our model's not going. In fact, even we have further provisions where we could, again, if you were to get into client portfolio, we could isolate by client portfolio, so they don't have to worry that our information or particular client's information is informing the decisions of another one. So we have put those checks and balances in place.
Another fear that investors have is something referred to as hallucinations. If you've ever played around with an AI chatbot, you probably know what I'm talking about, but just in case, we asked Andy to explain.
You know, I think everybody's heard about the term hallucination when it comes to these large models that they can make stuff up about the world. And this is, in fact, I think, one of the key elements of kind of the job that we have to do, which is to build systems and processes that make sure that what the AIs are telling us is truthful and accurate. So whether that means that we have AIs grading other AIs in terms of their truthfulness, whether that's still a role for humans in the loop here to validate the data. And indeed, I think, you know, when we think about kind of what are the facts that the models have access to, right? How do we build databases that they can, you know, rely on and not just take what they know about the world from their training data? I think those are all engineering problems that are kind of the key focus of building usable systems here, right? And I think ultimately that's where a lot of the, you know, the kind of additional value is going to get created.
The models are very, very enthusiastic to answer your questions, right? They want to provide an answer. And sometimes that's an answer that isn't actually based around facts, but rather it kind of hallucinates out. And so one of the things that we're seeing as these AI systems are built out is the importance of grounding them back to fundamental truths. And for us, that fundamental truth is our understanding of the markets, our understanding of client portfolios, and providing that as context directly to these AI solutions so that they can build upon those facts in its answers. And so we're not asking the AI to reason oftentimes, you know, beyond what we provided it. We're asking it to interpret the language that clients provide, asking it to interpret the textual data that we provide, but anchored back into the facts that we know about the market and their client portfolios.
A lot of what we're doing is also creating an intermediate layer between the large language model and the client. So for example, you might say, what was the return of Apple? That's meaningful to you. The large language model might get confused by that. Are we the large language model might not have the domain knowledge to know that you're talking about Apple computer. And so we'll go in and say, okay, they said Apple, let's map that to, you know, Apple Computer Inc. And then the return, well, what do you mean by the return? That's not totally precise. Well, we could go in and say the default is probably, you know, they want to know about today's return, but we can also ask them a clarifying question to see if they're interested in, you know, longer in a different horizon. So we're doing a lot of creating that. We're creating these little agents that help translate the language that our clients want to speak in to the precise language that the large language models need to operate.
You know, when you and I ask a question to someone, we're both staring at a risk report, say, and I say, hey, what's up with, I don't know, NVIDIA? What's up with some company, right? Or what's up with my portfolio or my factor exposure today, right? We're both staring at the same thing, and we know which portfolio you're talking about. We know what's going on in the news in our heads because we read it on the train in the morning. And that, you know, maybe we're staring at a chart and that chart has a big outlier in it, right? And we know what that chart's about. But when we're asking that question to an AI agent, we have to kind of fill in the blanks around that context for the agent, right? So that's kind of a key thing that, you know, I could ask a very precise question, but when I'm talking to someone naturally, I just kind of talk about it in a way that we both have a shared understanding about. So these are the kind of things that make these systems useful, is being able to kind of bring the AI into the same place of shared understanding as the person who's asking a question of it or asking it to do something. And that's really where we're focused. The key is to build systems that are grounded in reality and that kind of maintain data privacy and enforce guardrails and kind of fences here between, say, different clients' data sets, or even at the level of the interacting with users, right? If one client asks a question about their portfolio, we need to make sure that we maintain the privacy of that question, so that it doesn't, information about what that client was asking about doesn't leak across the guardrail to another client. We can do that. We can set up these systems so that clients are protected, and again, so that we are making sure that the information that the AIs have access to is all grounded in reality, and that we're not exposing ourselves to any kind of hallucination or otherwise sort of fabrication in the data. I think that the way that ultimately a lot of this works too is that more and more interaction with these systems mean that, you know, we're going to be in a position where we have like such a large validation set that we can kind of maintain a very high degree of accuracy. It's not just the system getting better, but it's also the users getting better at asking the system the right kind of questions. It's good for humans to ask more precise questions, even of other people. I think ultimately, the kind of concerns you raise there about like the fidelity of these systems, how good they are, how accurate they are, is an engineering challenge. And it's a challenge of, you know, not only making the systems more robust, but making the users of them, kind of more skilled, right, at asking good questions and at getting the most out of those things.
Feedback's very critical. It will help train the model get better, and therefore we can get more and more upstream. So this human in the loop will help get feedback, which will then go back in the model. The model will take that input and then drive more further inputs and enhancements.
Just as AI isn't as new as you might suspect, neither are companies' concerns about data fidelity and security. As Jay pointed out,
what jumps to mind as you speak that is kind of the cloud transition. We went from business software being installed locally on everyone's own desktop, right? Or companies had their own kind of local servers that managed these kind of business critical processes. And over 10 years, that has really shifted, right? Where the expectation now is software delivered as a service. There's lots of advantages associated with that for both the provider and the users. But you have to be comfortable with the solution itself, the security, the responsiveness, the performance, when it's no longer on site. And so the nice thing is that a lot of businesses have developed the right processes and controls in order to get familiar and comfortable with cloud-based software delivery. And so we can apply many of those same governance systems to generative AI and ensure that the same levels of control, of performance, of security apply to these new AI tech as we have our existing kind of cloud systems.
So let's get back to Peter's pillars of where AI can be the most immediately impactful. Let's dive into those three areas, starting with data. Where are we in terms of AI's ability to access the data, for users to input the data? What are some of the challenges?
So there's a huge amount of information out there that is unstructured. So it's a PDF document, it's a web page, it's the thing that we used to call a tweet. There's all kinds of information out there that is, it's information, it's data, but it's not yet in a form that's easily digestible. And AI or machine learning has been helping with this for some time, but it's still, a lot of it has still been very, very reliant on analysts. An analyst goes and reads a PDF and pulls out a handful of numbers from it and types those into a machine. And AI has been helping with this, but we're nearing a point where AI can help with that a lot more.
I think one of the things we're trying to overcome is scale. AI can actually help us extract that information at a scale, without us requiring deploying more humans at it. So that's one ability. The second ability is also go deeper into forming connections of why a particular data point changed and how it changed, giving us those patterns. And the third thing is the time it takes. Because in our industry, timing is very critical. If a news article breaks, say about a particular bank, like SVB Bank, let's just take that for an example. How does it impact a client's portfolio? There's a lot of tentacles to that. So the AI can help us pull out all the information and give us the right answer and point us the right direction.
One big change that's just starting to come online, the jargon is multimodal. And what that means is language is one mode, but pictures are another mode, and there are other modes. And being able to apply these models to both words and pictures at the same time opens up a lot of opportunities, and in particular, a lot of opportunities for data gathering. You got an investor report that has words in it and has a chart in it, and the AI will be able to read the words to provide the context to pull out the numbers that are plotted in the chart and correctly identify, okay, that number there is, this is a chart of the earnings of this portfolio company in US dollar, the quarterly earnings in US dollars of this portfolio company. So combining the information in the words with the information and charts and pictures to extract the data that really matters.
And that can be both on the input and the output, right? Now, say, reading all of the PDFs, looking at all the documents in a particular data set, say related to, court filings or, some exotic investments out in some market that's fairly small and doesn't have a very well-developed data ecosystem, right? Would allow you to, basically process large amounts of that, build signals, build structured data sets, and then take advantage of those new sources of data, right? So the idea here is that, ultimately, what multimodal does is just unlock more and more information that used to take humans a long time to process and score and so forth, and do it automatically, right? So again, the cost of all of this kind of data gathering will go down quite a lot with these multimodal capabilities.
Okay, then if that's the data portion, let's kind of move into, like you said, you use the term multimodal, combination of, it sounds like actually three things, if I'm following, numbers, words, and images, and understanding how to pull information off of all three. How has that impacted the way that models are built and are used or will be in the future?
Yeah, so we think that there's an opportunity to really change the role of models. So as I mentioned, models traditionally have taken in numbers and spit out other numbers. And that's pretty useful for a lot of things, especially that's useful for the very quantitatively inclined investor. But there's a lot of information out there that is in words. And to be able to have a model combine the information in numbers and the information in words is potentially extremely powerful. Probably the most, there's a lot of aspects of it that are really exciting. Probably the most is for the first time being able to get at sort of what are the events and the causes that are really driving things. So traditional models look at returns and say, okay, this went up and this also went up and they're correlated. That's useful. And there are various things to tease apart that further. But what's really exciting is to be able to say this went up and this also went up. And there was a news article over here that seemed to be the driver of both. And so being able to say that this event was the cause that drove these potentially gives us a whole lot more insight than just looking at the numerical data together.
One of the things that we're really excited about is being able to link together news and events that are occurring during the day against impacts in the overall market and the client portfolios. And understanding kind of the world of investments through the combination of both text data, right, news, events, as well as kind of quantified data that MSCI has obviously been very, very familiar with and strong with for many years. And so we're looking at how to understand particular earnings announcements, particular macro changes in the environment, how those sorts of news events can then impact client portfolios. That way, clients can understand and tell the story of those portfolios more effectively, right? This is what's happening right now in my portfolio. But then looking out at the future even and saying, okay, there's a news event or earnings call coming up soon. What sort of impact could that have across my portfolio? Or some sort of macro, the CPI is going to print again here later this week. What am I most sensitive to when it comes to that?
And so that becomes really powerful. That becomes really powerful to make the model smarter. And then it becomes really powerful also in terms of moving to the third pillar, which is interaction, making models a lot more useful and usable to those who aren't quantitatively inclined. So rather than being mostly useful to people who are really fluent in numbers, enabling people to interact with a model using their natural language, asking the question that they really care about, and being able to get a model to answer it, saying, I have a scenario in mind. What stocks will be the winners and losers of this scenario? I think a lot of people who aren't quants could find that useful. Saying, in words, I have the following idea for a strategy. Can you go and back test it for me? You don't need to be a quant to be able to interact with a lot of quantitative tools under the hood in that framework. So I think that there's a couple angles to this. One is just the things, the signal that would be pretty obvious to you if you could read everything out there. But then the next step is starting to draw connections between them. The AI is able to pick up emerging themes and topics. So roll back the clock. It's the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. There was a lot of news about Silicon Valley Bank all of a sudden, just a couple of days before it really collapsed. And there was news on it. And then the time horizon that this was incorporated in the market was, days rather than seconds. And so there was a window there for the AI to pick up on, oh, that's interesting. There's a whole lot more news about Silicon Valley Bank. And your portfolio has more than average exposure to Silicon Valley Bank. Not sure what the AI doesn't know what's going to happen next, but the AI can make that connection and call it out to you. And then you can go and look into it further. You as a smart person can think about what should I do, and can also think about, okay, well, what does that mean next? Okay, Silicon Valley Bank, does that mean that there's a broader regional bank exposure? Okay, let me know. That's my idea. The smart person. But regional banks, the AI hasn't made that connection, but the AI can then help you assess your exposure to regional banks more broadly when you've had that thought.
I think we're starting to see the benefits and across different providers around data processing, right? Data extraction, data translation, being able to kind of pull content out of textual and other sorts of natural language news sources and bring it into the modeling process. That's, I think, the area where there's the greatest benefit so far, if you will, has been more kind of internal processes for a lot of the large players. We're starting to see now the first applications of this technology into user experiences. And I think that as we go through it over the next few years, we're gonna see some really powerful models where clients working, investment professionals working to co-create content with AI could be very interesting.
So think of it like a big funnel, right? The AI can help you quickly distill information into usable signals and help you understand what's going on, process a lot more information, and to kind of help you focus on what's important. by connecting the dots across a lot of different information sources, it can help explain what's going on, getting more quickly to the why behind what's happening to your portfolio, say, right? And then finally, the AI can actually help you take action. You know, whether that's diving deeper with further analysis, like what used to take a lot of time, maybe back and forth with an analyst to do some kind of code and look at some data, the AI can help you do that really, really fast. Or even making changes to your portfolio, right? You know, you can do kind of what-if analysis. You can think about what executing a bunch of different slight variations around a strategy would look like. All the AI can help you do all this stuff. So again, we think of it as kind of, you know, attention, what should I look at? Explanation, why is what happening? And then action, like what actions can I take and how can I make those faster? Going from days to a few seconds along the way.
At this point, you might be saying, Adam, this sounds great, wonderful even, but complicated. Honestly, I don't even know where to begin. If only I could ask Andy DeMond for some pointers. Well, don't worry. We did.
The first steps are to think about all of these kind of concerns that we've mentioned, right? Think about kind of the upside and the downside. What are you trying to accomplish? What processes are you trying to make faster? What are you trying to do in terms of building efficiency and building new data sets, connecting the dots across data sets? And then how are you going to safeguard or how are you going to deal with some of the downside stuff, right? How are you going to deal with the hallucination problems and the like, you know? So working with a vendor like MSCI, who has a lot of domain expertise and can build and has sort of thought about these problems, is, I think, a really useful way to go. Keeping on top of the rapidly evolving landscape in the space, right? So there's new models coming out all the time. There's new capabilities, new frameworks. You know, how are you gonna kind of maintain expertise when the systems and the landscape is changing so rapidly, right? We're expecting foundation models and their capabilities to continue to evolve at a rapid pace for a while, right? And so, building a system and kind of integrating a system that can take advantage of that, you know, you have to plan ahead.
As for how MSCI has been handling that particular question.
We have partnerships with Google. We have partnerships with Microsoft. We're talking to OpenAI now. We're talking to Snowflake, which is also providing some AI capabilities. We've spoken to Databricks. We've spoken to most of the Mistral, which just got recently funded. We're talking to all these partners. And the way we're adapting is we're looking at doing a trade-off between the one that gives us the best value at the best price and at the best latency. And the reason why I say latency is the best client experience, because we have seen, and if you go read, there are shortages of GPUs out there where a particular query could take up to a minute. We don't want our clients waiting. So we try to do trade-offs between client experience, cost, and value. And what we do is we ensure that there's no one solution that fits all. So we're making an open partnership across all these companies and getting the best of the best into our applications, into our systems, and utilizing that to provide the best value for our clients and ourselves. So that's how we're approaching these partnerships. In fact, one of the things we're doing on April 9th at Google Next in Las Vegas is we're actually presenting a talk about how we're using AI to identify climate risk for sustainable finance. I would definitely encourage all of you to attend it. We have a very strong engineering and research team. We have an AI roundtable discussion that happens on a bi-weekly basis where a combination of our researchers and engineers come and share their learnings. The individual teams are plugged in. So innovation's happening at a much faster pace.
As I said at the top of the show, AI is coming. It's here, actually. I asked Peter Shepard to sum up his feelings about it, and he sounded hopeful.
So it's the potential to just transform the way investors think about the world. The potential to make information much, much more useful to investors so that investors can really take where they add the most value, focus on that, and then let, you know, pretty much everything else happen, you know, more or less automatically for them. I think that's the world that we're going to, of just tremendous efficiency, to enable, you know, the really smart investors to really add value and to not have to deal with any of the frictions that can be so common.
That's all for this week. Our thanks to all four of our guests, Peter, Andy, Jay, and Dipesh, and of course to all of you for listening. If you like what you hear, we'd love to hear from you. Why not let us know by leaving a comment or rating on your podcast platform of choice? Until next time, I'm your host, Adam Bass, and this is MSCI Perspectives. Stay safe, everyone.